Good evening, friends. Thank you for tuning in to Valley Writers Read. This is your host, Franz Weinschenk. Welcome to a locally produced program where you get to hear stories from only authors who reside right here in the San Joaquin Valley. Tonight, a really provocative story by a Fresno author that we've had on our show quite a few times. I'm talking about Ed Miller. Ed entitles his story tonight, Blur. And here he is to read it for us. Ed Miller reading Blur.
It was just one of those things, just one of those craziest flings, one of those bells that now and then rings, just one of those things. It was just one of those nights, just one of those fabulous flights, a trip to the moon on gossamer wings, just one of those things.
Blur. For some reason, the Dotellos always made me sick. I mean, they made me sick physically and sick in every other way. Listening to them talk, watching their mouths move and jabber, listening as their voices strangely disembodied themselves and rose in an odious fog before me and rolled in black waves through my head, or simply being around them, the Dotellos, in a restaurant, at a bar, being close, just being there in that same small, desperate space, was for me a test of extraordinary suffering. It was a combination of pathologies, I suppose. Taken separately, maybe I could have handled them. Individually, they might have been all right, under other circumstances, and another time, perhaps. But not together. Together, they were poison. Not surprisingly, the Dotellos were friends of Susan's, my lovely wife. They came with Susan when I married her, a part of the domestic package, as it were. For the last 2 years, the Dotellos had rented a place a half-hour's drive north of Los Angeles in an unincorporated area of light industry and anonymous warehouses. Their small, tract home was a modest three-bedroom, one-bath structure with a meager yard, flat roof, and single-car garage, an unassuming abode built in the 50s and set against the Santa Clarita Mountains in a great smear of smog and soot, just above the 210 freeway and 3 miles down the road from a shuttered Occidental chemical plant. They were one of those couples for whom things were always astir. Something was always shaking with the Dotellos. Jerry was changing jobs, under vague circumstances usually, or Gina was selling Avon, Mary Kay, Tupperware, or they were leasing a new car, having just wrecked the last one, or they were moving out of state, or they were deciding to stay, or they were suing somebody, or they were heading off on a road trip to some redemptive locale like Vegas or Reno. They had no children, rather they had no children together. Jerry had 2 grown daughters, with whom he rarely spoke and only then by long distance, to tell them, often as not, that he was sorry but he was flat broke this month, Reno, Vegas, and didn't have any dough to send them to help them defray their college expenses. Still, they were good young people by all accounts, Liz and Kelsey, and assiduous students, products of a brief and lonely marriage in the years after Jerry had signed up for the service. By the time Jerry had retired as a tech sergeant from the Army at the age of 46, he had divorced Belinda, his first wife, and had already met and married Gina. Gina, however, was a leg up on Jerry. When she and Jerry had married, she was already twice divorced, from the same husband, in fact, Rick Burnett. Burnett, a long-haul trucker, was a Tennessee cowboy and a smoldering ember in Gina's life, to couch it in the language of one of those dog-eared Harlequin romances she kept stashed in her purse. And Burnett had the bad habit of showing up at just the wrong time, which could be any time. Gina had an adult son, Marco, who lived in Vancouver. Their relationship was, like Jerry's relationship with his daughters, unintentionally estranged. There would be an occasional phone call, then say a year would pass, then maybe a snapshot would appear in the mailbox at Christmas time. That's pretty much the way things stood with these two, Gina and Jerry Dotello, an American couple. I was in the middle of preparing my lightly regarded pasta with bacon and arugula the night the Dotellos called for the last time. It was after 7, and the phone rang in the kitchen, and occupied as I was with fettuccine and such, I hollered to Susan to catch it, and she did, picking up the phone and walking into the living room, talking animatedly, trailing the long cord behind her. I can usually determine who's on the other end of the line by the way Susan talks to them. I conclude in short order that it was the DTs again, specifically Gina. The phone call ticked me off. I had missed lunch and was hungry and wanted to eat, and suddenly here comes one of those long-winded conversations that throws off the whole dinner schedule. I got a beer out of the refrigerator, turned down the burner under the stock pot, and settled into a grim slouch in one of the swivel chairs at the dinette. I always resign myself to this kind of thing. I don't know why. Susan said, "And when did this happen?" I worked at the bottle cap with an opener and popped it with that familiar chit. "In August?" Susan frowned. "And then what?" The beer tasted good. It was a German Pilsner. On the label was a well-endowed Brunhilde. I began to peel the label back as if undressing her. "I don't get it," Susan said. The whole label came off. Mein Liebchen. "Oh, wow," Susan said. "So it's all squared away, then." This rambled on for a while, then Jerry picked up the extension and the conversation flared into a new cosmic stream. Susan curled her legs under her and shifted the receiver from one shoulder to the other. "I remember," she giggled. "I sure do. Your husband's crazy, Gina. I'm going to get him back. I'm going to get you good, Jer. You hear me? You're on my list, bucko. Watch yourself." I wondered how much beer I had left. "Now that's an idea," she continued. "I don't know. Let me ask him." Susan turned and said, "Gina and Jerry want to know if we'd like to go to dinner with them tonight." "Tonight? I'm making dinner. Ask them to come over here. There's plenty of food." "But Ralph, you just started." Susan was holding her hand over the receiver. "You just started making dinner. They want to take us out." I took a long pull on my beer. "Are you kidding?" I said. "I'm in the middle of this. Look at this." I swept my hand in the direction of the kitchen, was where everything was spilled out in disarray. Susan cocked an eyebrow. "It's late," I said. "But they want to take us to the Atchison Grill. Come on. The Atchison Grill. Will you go with them?" Susan looked at me, and I felt her eyes penetrate my skull like a laser beam, and I could almost smell the smoke from the exit wounds. "But they want to treat us," she said, narrowing her voice. "I don't care," I said. "I'm in the middle. Look at this. I'm making..." "Oh, hell, okay, all right then." Susan turned back in her chair and continued midstream. "Sure, that would be great," she said. "No, it's not too late. Not a problem, Gina." "No, of course not. Why don't we meet? That way you don't have to come way out here and then go back again." I abandoned my chair and walked back into the kitchen in loathing and disgust. I had punted. "What would be a good time?" Susan asked. "How about next year?" I offered. "After Labor Day, or maybe the Feast of Embraining." "Oh, that'd be fine, Gina. Okay, 8:30 then."
If we thought a bit of the end of it when we started painting the town, we'd have been aware that our love affair was too hot not to cool down. So goodbye, dear.
The Atchison Grill sat on the corner of a trendy shopping center and was several miles closer to our place than to Jerry and Gina's. We'd made no reservations, so we left our name with a hostess and wandered to the bar to wait for the Dotellos. As the dulcet croonings of Dean Martin breezed overhead, I asked the server for my German Pilsner. She apologized and said they didn't stock it, and somehow I wasn't surprised. So I asked for a Heineken instead, and Susan looked at the color pictures on the drink menu and picked out a giant fruit bowl thing full of Bacardi and blue fluorescent light. The evening was taking off. The drinks came, and we sat and passed the time talking about important matters, such as what fabric our sofa should be made of, when and if we finally decided to get a new one. And maybe we ought to get a battery for the Ford, because the old one seemed to be on its last legs, and maybe this year we should go to Susan's mom's for Christmas just for a change. And was our neighbor to the north of us, the mysterious one, gay, or was she just lately taking an interest in cross-dressing? These and similar topics that occupy so much idle colloquy among couples. Two more drinks followed the first, and I kept an eye on my watch and began to wonder about the Dotellos and wondered if they were ever going to show or had they merely become entangled in some new misadventure. Then I thought about my pasta at home, sitting in the garbage. At 9 o'clock, the Dotellos rolled in. In fact, they blasted into the room at full tilt, as was their custom. Gina's shrill and nasal Sturm und Drang, nearly emptying the room of life, with what remained only to be swept clean by Jerry's hornblower ad nauseums. "Susan, how are you, dear? It's so good to see you. Oh, Gina, give me a hug." They flung themselves around each other as if they'd been siblings separated at birth and were now deliriously reunited. "So much has happened, and so many things are happening. Sit down. Come on, let's all sit down here. There's room." "Ralph, you look great, old sport." "Well, thanks, Jerry." I looked over. "Hey, maybe our table's ready." I jumped up and made my way to the hostess's stand and inquired after our table. 20 minutes, she said. The place was packed. There was a line out the door. I went back and sat down again. "Boy, they're busy," I said, "aren't they?" But no one heard me. It was like talking into a wood chipper. Anything I said was chewed up the moment it came out of my mouth and sprayed in pieces all over the room. So I assumed the position, reclining slightly in my chair and endeavoring to impose a zen-like silence through a sheer force of will. At some point, I became aware of the general drift of the conversation and decided to assay the maw of the wood chipper once more. Jerry was out of work again. "So when did you leave this job?" I said, raising my voice to an unpleasant volume. 4 weeks ago, I'd had it with those idiots. I can't work under those conditions." "It was awful," Gina said. "They cut Jerry's car allowance, and then they began hassling him about his per diem." "They are real jerks down there," Jerry said. "They even threw me into cold calls with the rookies. No, I'll never work for them again. I'd go back to Bollinger's before I'd sell for months again. Advertising is a game I understand. A lot more than some of the jerks I've worked for, at least. Anyway, you're looking good. Looks like you might have lost some weight. I'll bet you're still going to the gym." "Oh, yeah, are you kidding? I wish. The gym's just a little pricey right now, but I still hit the old Nautilus machine at home. Every night I'm out there in the garage busting iron. Right, Gina?" "My gosh, yes, Ralph. Jerry's very dedicated to his fitness. Reps and reps and reps. I put it in, boy. You should try it." His face was close to mine. I slid back in my chair a little more. "Beer tender," I shouted, and waved a hand at our server. "Mas cervezas, merci beaucoup." The night tore on, and we were all well torched by the time we were led weaving to our table. We must have waited an hour or more in the bar. The waitress had one of those long-suffering smiles, and when at last she took our order, I saw that we were making a loud and obnoxious presence of ourselves. "What's this?" Gina asked, holding up the menu to the waitress. "Is this shrimp?" "That's our scampi, yes." "How do they cook it?" "It's a little Cajun, a little spicy. It's really good." "I hate shrimp," Gina said. "Just hate it. Crawly little creepies." Gina revolved through 6 or 7 other entrees while giving the waitress the third degree and making faces and describing the various faults and obvious shortcomings of this and that for the benefit of those within earshot. In the end, she ordered something safe, the salmon almondine, I think, and I felt the jaws of the vice on my neck back off just so. But Jerry was next. He proceeded to interrogate the waitress in a similarly incoherent fashion, waving the menu around, demanding answers. "How do you cook the veal? Are these pearl onions? Fresh or frozen? What kind of salad? What kind of soup? Are those the only two kinds of soup? Can I get beets instead of carrots? How do you cook the beets?" Why didn't waitresses shoot people more often? That's what I wondered. Finally, Jerry submitted his order. It was more of a proclamation. "Hear ye, hear ye." I pictured him in high buckle shoes, frock coat, and powdered wig. Then Susan ordered, and then it was my turn. "I'll have the scampi," I blurted. "Scampi's the ticket. Tell chef to fix it any way he wants. I don't care. Soup, salad, vegetables, lumps of coal, whatever. But definitely another one of these." I tilted the empty glass toward her. "Keep them coming, Fräulein." The waitress nodded, collected the menus, and fled. The roar and din redoubled. Gina fidgeted, and Jerry gestured wildly, and Susan rocked her head back and forth and laughed, and I sat there with my mouth agape, eyes wide, staring. All was a whirl, all was agog. I felt as though chained to some kind of medieval fire-belching calliope. We would have finished about 11, probably, but somewhere during the course of the meal, our friends fell into a quarrel. Jerry remarked that Gina was an insufferable bitch. He'd said it half sarcastically, but Gina went ballistic. She launched into a fusillade of invective and spat venom like a cobra. Then she commenced a blistering recitation of Jerry's many transgressions. "You're not worth a damn," she declared, "as a husband, as a father, or a man. You're a bum." This turned some heads, those few that hadn't turned already. "You put everything on me," she continued. "You don't take any responsibility for anything. You blame me for your screw-ups." "Why don't you just stuff a rag in it?" Jerry said. "Why don't you go to hell?" "Guys," Susan said, "hey, come on." The manager appeared and asked us to keep it down. He was getting complaints. "Really?" I said. He looked at me. "We're working on a peace process here, boss. We'll be good, we promise." The ceasefire was short-lived. Soon Gina was weeping again and muttering obscenities. Jerry pivoted in his seat and began talking to Susan, ignoring Gina. I had to make a pit stop for the third time and got a funny glance, or thought so, from a guy leaving the bathroom as I was going in. "Problem, buddy?" He didn't reply and kept going. I felt like decking someone. I went in and the room spun and I looked at my face in the mirror and it was an ugly face, the face of a caveman. What was I doing here? This was horrible. This was death. This was the end. I wandered over the urinal, and on the wall above it noticed someone had scribbled in black felt marker, "Christ is seen in our service to others." I washed up afterwards, and my feet pounded heavily along the carpeted aisle back to the table. Jerry and Gina were gone when I returned. "Where's the wild bunch?" I asked. "They left," Susan said. "Your zipper's open." "God," I cinched up. "Do you always have to drink so much? Here, pay this." Susan handed me the bill and gathered her purse and coat. "What the hell?" I said. I hung onto the chair with one hand and studied the damage. "I thought you said this was their treat, huh? This is messed up, Suze." I looked around. Suddenly I was talking to nobody. Susan had bailed. I spotted her wicked heels disappearing through the door. It was almost midnight and I was feeling ill. At the exit, I paused by the cash register and let my Visa card absorb another body shot, and then I headed out, but I didn't get very far. I folded up the news racks and spewed, and then I let go again. It was a bad scene, but I pulled myself together and mopped my mouth with a handkerchief and walked on. I found Susan in the parking lot. "Kiss me," I said. "Oh, give me the damn key," she said. "You're in no condition, no kind of condition." She hung on the door handle and worked it up and down with effort. I informed her that this wasn't our car. "This is a white Sable," I said. "Ours is a white Taurus." "What the..." She peered through the glass. Then she released the door handle and the alarm went off. Let's get out of here, she said. Where's our car? Over there, where we left it. We walked and stumbled and walked to where our car was parked, and Susan said, You drive. I don't feel so good. I unlocked the doors, and we climbed in and sat there a moment. Susan slowly slid back in her seat and closed her eyes. You know, I said, Christ is seen in our service to others. Huh? That was written on a wall in the can, a little graffito. I saw it when we went in. Christ is seen in our service to others. What do you think about that? Don't talk to me about Christ, she said. Oh, she put her hands over her face. I drank too much, she said. Sometimes it's hard to start a conversation, and my woman was out of it anyway. I let it slide. I put the key in the ignition and turned it, but the engine didn't kick over. There was just this click-click from the starter. The battery was dead. Glory to God on the Most High, I said. We went back to the restaurant and called a cab and waited. It grew colder. I told Susan I didn't think I could handle another dinner with the Detellos. I didn't think I had it in me. She said she didn't think she could handle it either. On the cab ride home, the driver had to pull behind a 7-Eleven so Susan could jump out and throw up. It was a wonderful performance, and I applauded. At 5 minutes to 5, I was jolted awake by the ringing of the phone. I lay there under the blankets with the clock radio casting its lonely glow in the corner of the room. But the phone kept ringing, kept on. They wouldn't give up. I groaned and got up and went to the kitchen and answered it. But it was a wrong number, someone shouting in my ear. I couldn't understand them, so I hung up, unplugged the phone, and went back to bed. Sometime the next morning, I connected the phone again and called work. Don Wheeler, senior manager at the claim center, picked up and I said, This is Gillespie, Mr. Wheeler, Ralph Gillespie. I can't come in today. I'm sick. I think I may be coming down with pleurisy, but I'm not sure. Pleurisy? Holy cow, will you rest then? Yeah, thank you. I coughed miserably and hung up. I imagine Wheeler walking through the maze of cubicles and desks, asking people, What the hell's pleurisy anyway? I went into the bathroom and crawled into the shower and pointed the shower head down and sat like a supplicant on the tile and let the hot water wash over me. It felt good. The previous night had come screaming back into my head all at once, and hot water was the only way to drown it out. Around noon, I started getting dressed while Susan still lay curled in bed, moaning. I'm dying, she said. The covers were pulled over the top of her head and her voice was muffled. Ralph, I hurt so much. Oh, my God. Can I have some water? I got an iced tea glass from the cupboard and filled it and put it on the nightstand beside her. I'm going for the car, I said. Your husband is on the case. Susan mumbled something, and I left. Lynn, a kid from the apartment below us, gave me a lift to the restaurant. We hooked up some jumper cables to his old Datsun sedan and ran them to the Taurus and sat there while the battery charged. Then I climbed in, fired up the Taurus, and gave him the thumbs up. Hey, Lynn said, you owe me your life. I'll pay you tomorrow, Lynn. I unhooked the cables, looped them into a bundle, and stowed them in the trunk. Well, how about a beer then? Got time? Gonna have to pass on that, good buddy. Front me a rain check, will you? Got you covered, Mr. G. I drove out of the parking lot and into the slow, aimless stream of traffic. My wife and I conducted a brief post-mortem over coffee and cold pizza. Susan said things really disintegrated after I left for the restroom for the last time. I allowed that I gathered as much and asked if it had anything to do with Rick, the wayward trucker. His name may have been mentioned, Susan said. Casting a stain on the festivities, I said. They were cutting up back and forth, and you left, and then Jerry sort of tapped her forehead, Gina's forehead, like this. Susan popped me with the heel of her hand. Jesus, I said, watch it. You know I have delicate skin. Gina was pretty-faced. She gave him a taste of the business end of her charger plate, right in the kisser. And then the manager stepped in and ejected the players. Game over. With friends like that, I said, you need a whip and a chair, and maybe a mojo hand. I know, Susan said. They're high maintenance, all right. I know that. But they're my friends, Ralph. I don't want to lose them. They're a couple of certified nut jobs, I replied. You need your head examined.
Yes, just one of those things. Mama, just one of those crazy slings. One of those bells that now and then rings. It's just one of those things, oh.
That night, the phone rang, and Susan picked it up while we were watching the last episode of Survivor. I hit the mute button on the remote and let Susan talk unmolested. I guess it must have been a 3 or 4 minute call, maybe longer. When it was over, I knew something had gone way wrong. That was LAPD, Susan said. Even in the shadows, I saw that Susan's face was blanched, stunned. Gina's dead, she said. My God, I said, what happened? Susan stood there, and she sank next to me onto the sofa. She's dead. A gun. Jerry's gun. No way. Christ. Jerry's downtown right now giving a statement. Susan paused, gazed at the ceiling, continued. The detective, the man on the phone, rustled somebody. I don't know. He's... Says they'll probably want to talk to us, too. Oh, Ralph. I held Susan and said, I'll be damned, I can't believe it. Then I thought, the phone call. Well, we were indeed questioned the following Friday, separately. Susan and I, in a windowless interview room at the police department annex, a low red brick building adjacent to City Hall Plaza. The funeral, closed coffin, wouldn't be until the next day, Saturday. I waited while my wife was interviewed, and then we traded places, Susan waiting on the bench in the hallway while I went in. The investigator conducting the interview was a youngish man of small frame with a quiet, rather European demeanor. His name was Mansour. He adjusted his rimless glasses and apologized for my wife and I having to make the long trip rather than meeting us somewhere more convenient, but said that his schedule was tight and his caseload heavy, and he hoped we didn't mind. And anyway, he said, as longtime friends of the Detellos, I felt confident you and your wife would want to do what you could. Of course, I said, absolutely. He sat down across from me, flipped open a legal pad, uncapped a pen, and proceeded to ask several questions about Gina, then about Jerry, and about the relationship. Sitting there, I'd have to have been a dope not to infer that Jerry was a suspect of some kind, or at least a person of interest. At bottom, I thought it was a baseless notion. I mean, good God. There wasn't any possibility that Jerry would have, and it was hard even getting my head around the idea. Shot Gina. They fought, sure, had their disagreements like a lot of couples, married or not. Susan and I could both attest to that. But a squabble is a long way from homicide. I just wanted to get some sense of the Detellos, Mansour continued, as a couple, outside of and beyond what transpired in their living room. I understand, I said, sure. We definitely want to bring some closure to this, get it off our books, so to speak. And as I said, longtime friends or acquaintances such as yourselves often provide a unique perspective into the world of two people which might otherwise be closed to inspection. We're all so estranged, you know, nowadays, as human beings. It's almost hard to identify our friends, Mr. Gillespie. We're separated, disconnected. And yet here we are, all together. How do we explain that? I really don't know. We lie to each other, that's how. It's a process of concealment. We conceal the truth about who we are, our motives. It's never simply a question of alienation. In fact, our lives are deeply hidden, and others know us only by the masks we wear. Interesting theory, I said. Someone called you from the Detello residence the morning of the incident, very early. That's what phone records indicate. That and a 911 shortly afterward. Then nothing. I nodded and looked past Mansour to the large picture of Yosemite that hung on the wall. The summit of El Capitan was blanketed in mist. Anything you can share about that phone call, Mr. Gillespie? Yeah, we did get a call. I answered it, but I thought it was a wrong number. Somebody yelling in my ear. I hung up, unhooked the phone, and went back to bed. We'd been out all night. You didn't recognize the voice? Well, looking back, I guess it had to be Jerry, but I sure didn't know it at the time. What did he say? Your guess is as good as mine. I have no idea, really. It was a scream, a howl, you know. I thought it could have been a prank, maybe. Some kid jerking me around. Mansour paused, revolved the pin in his hand, put it down. Your wife said the four of you had gone to dinner together. What was the mood? At dinner, there was a lot of drinking, that's about all I can say. Any arguments, any words exchanged? Well, things kind of fell apart toward the end, I'm sure Susan told you. They were both pretty trashed, Jerry and Gina. They lobbed recriminations, got pushy with each other, got physical, I mean. You could say it went a little sideways. Mansour said, that corresponds with your wife's observations. Let me ask you this. Do you believe Mrs. Detello took her own life? I don't have any reason to think she didn't, I answered. But as you suggest, how well can we know someone, really? These two were friends of my wife. Susan's known Gina for years, all the way back to college. She's close with Jerry, too, but me, I didn't spend a lot of time with them. The less the better, in fact. That night, I just went along for the ride, and I guess what I thought was going to be a free meal. What does Jerry say happened? His story's a little sketchy, Mansour said, though don't quote me on that. And the forensics are a bit ambiguous, unfortunately. So these are just a couple of the items we're trying to sort out. Anyway, I want to thank you for coming down. Thank your wife for me, too. I'll call you if I have any further questions. But there were no further questions, other than the ones posed by the darkness and the cold silence on the nights after Susan and I went to bed and lay there and couldn't sleep. We'd talk about it then, at those times. Gina's death, what had happened, or what might have happened, who was to say? The funeral passed quickly, the days and months followed. What was left was what we'd been told. That sometime after 2 a.m. on November 19th, Regina Maria Detello, age 41, had showered, slipped into a bathrobe, retrieved from a bureau drawer a Walther PPK belonging to her husband, and had walked into the living room, where she sat down on the edge of a coffee table, released the trigger lock on the weapon, and squeezed off around and ended everything. An unaccountable flame out. The report was closed, no complaint was ever filed. By midsummer, Jerry had split, moved east. He had some family there in Chicago, apparently. Some cousins, somebody said. I remember Gina's ex-old man came around afterwards, wanting answers, but there were none to give. This morning I awoke to the sound of the TV coming from the other room, that cheesy theme from The Love Boat. Love, exciting and new, come aboard, we're expecting you. What a load, I thought. I rolled on my side and punched the pillow twice.
Was Fresno author Ed Miller reading Blur. Well, to begin with, Ralph didn't want to go out with the DiTellos because he was already in the middle of fixing dinner at home. But Susan talked him into it, and when they got to the Atchison Grill, there was a lot of drinking, and the DiTellos got into a big argument that ended in a physical fight. Later that night, they get a phone call. But all Ralph could hear was some incomprehensible screaming. It wasn't until the next day that they found out that Gina DiTello had been shot dead. They were both interviewed by the police. Bottom line, we really don't know what actually happened. All we know is that the official version tells us that at 2:30 in the morning, Gina DiTello retrieved a gun and squeezed off a round that ended her life. Friends, our author tonight, Ed Miller, hardly needs any introduction inasmuch as he has appeared on our program many times, each time with a fascinating story, and, as we heard, tonight was no exception. His fiction has appeared in West Branch, The Antigonish Review, and Whiskey Island. His chapbook, entitled The Whole Enchilada, was published by Cervina Barva Press. He works for the United States Immigration Service. We want to thank him for such a searing story tonight, and we're sure we'll be able to air more of his fine fiction on future programs. And so we come to the end of another edition of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to listen to tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read story again, just get online at kvpr.org and click on to Valley Writers Read. Next week, our author will be Valerie Schultz. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio, produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.